with Custodians of the Planet. I'm Deniz Yıldız. Custodians of the Planet brings consciousness to planetary challenges and looks at different perspectives regarding the tensions and harmony of human activities in a changing climate. This week's episode is about a new book called The Routledge Handbook of Eco-Cultural Identity. This book is a manifesto for a paradigm shift from Anthropocene to Humulocene. Yes, Humulocene. It's a new term and we will talk about very soon. The handbook interrogates dominant paradigms and offers alternative ways of being and understandings of the self. It entices the reader's curiosity by introducing a more than human lens that is imminent in all living beings. The handbook's 40 international authors are from a wide variety of disciplinary and multidisciplinary backgrounds and crafted chapters which develop and apply an eco-cultural lens while examining the reasons, ramifications, and possible resolutions for anthropocenic environmental problems. This handbook is an important resource for our times, for scholars, teachers, students, protectors, policymakers, and practitioners interested in ecological and sociocultural regeneration. Today we have three contributors. The first two, Tema and John, are with me right in front of my eyes. Tema Milstein is an associate professor of environment and society at the University of New South Wales. Her work looks at the way culture, society and discourse inform and are informed by earthly relations. Her research interests include eco-cultural meaning systems and communication, ecotourism and endangered wildlife, eco-cultural activism and eco-culture jamming. John Carr is a senior lecturer in environment and society at the University of New South Wales and associate professor in geography and environmental studies at the University of New Mexico. His research and teaching are broad-based, exploring the intersections of law, politics, planning, culture, and technology, with a particular focus on cities, their environments, and their place in the modern human world. Jose Castro Sotomayor joins us from California. Jose is an assistant professor at California State University, Channel Islands. His work investigates environmental and intercultural dynamics of human and more than human communication, agency, and dissent. Tema, John, and Jose, welcome to Custodians of the Planet. It's an honor to have you on the show. Congratulations on the publication of the handbook. Actually, we also have Taylor Coyne in the studio with us, who is a dear colleague of mine, and recently he has embarked on a PhD journey at UNSW. I think this is the first time we're recording in front of a live audience. How exciting. I'm delighted to welcome you all.
Thank you for having us.
First, I'd like to begin with the key concepts. This handbook introduces a couple of new terms, one of which is, of course, eco-cultural identity. What is eco-cultural identity and what drove you want to create a handbook on it?
Yeah, I think Jose and I can both talk to this. This is a new term, but it's a very, very old way of understanding selfhood, right? And we're introducing this new term because it has been progressively more absent from our ways of understanding identity through all sorts of forces, right? I mean, colonization, westernization, globalization, international market capitalist forces, all of these forces and structures that remain in place today that are very much about making the ecological aspects of ourselves invisible to us and even deniable, right? So eco-cultural identity is about bringing the ecological turn to our notions of ourselves. And so we understand ourselves, we tend to understand ourselves as cultural, we tend to understand ourselves as social beings, but the ecological turn brings in the ecological dimensions of ourselves in every aspect of what we do. And I think one important thing to point out is that when we talk about eco-cultural identity, it's not, oh, you know, I'm an environmentalist, I have an eco-cultural identity. It's that every single identity is eco-cultural. So from the most destructive to the most restorative, every identity always has ecological elements.
Yes, and one idea about the cultural framework, I would say, is that we challenge the idea that the environmental is separate from or subsidiary from the economic, the political, the historical, or the cultural dimensions, right, of the form, the self. So these ecological affiliations, as Tema mentioned, are also non-normative. That's the idea we have. You know, it is not always restorative or always positive, right, that as other kind of identities frame the self. So what we're trying to do is to expand the idea of identity in terms of how we connect to what we call in the handbook the more than human world, which is a term that comes from David Abram. That was a very inspirational work that we mentioned in this book.
Yeah, and when we were discussing this earlier, one of the things that I think is really powerful to realize is that at a certain level, almost every aspect of our daily lives are profoundly environmental. They're ecological. If we think about two things that have massive environmental impacts, the fashion industry, which has a huge impact in terms of waste, water, and resources. We talk about global consumption of meat, huge contributions to, obviously, climate crisis and soil degradation, right? These are really driven by intimately personal, identity-based choices. Most of us, the majority of us, have enough clothing to cover our nudity and to keep warm enough, right? But we keep buying clothes because of our identities, because of our cultural performances. So this sort of identity sense really drives this huge set of ecological dynamics. And likewise, we think of meat as just something we eat or something we do as part of a community or a group or part of celebrations. And this cultural component has very much an invisible environmental dimension to it. And so when I was sort of responding to the call for chapters, I was really thinking about how this can lead us to think about how all sorts of other dimensions of our identities have these often unspoken or unthought about or largely invisible environmental dimensions.
And can I add one other thing? I mean, I think that what we're describing right now sounds like it's very individual, right? Like, how does each individual identify? But I think that is part of the book, right? Is how do we perceive and behave at a personal scale? But then to scale that up, right? That's something the book does as well. So what does that mean? What does that mean for communities? What does that mean for countries? What does that mean for institutions, for policy, for government? All of these things are in conversation, so that we often think about environmental things either just at an individual or just at a kind of large scale, structural scale. But what this is helping us do is to also understand it from that personal level and how that's always interconnected.
It is a courageous attempt, I think, to delve into such a complex issue. Can you talk a bit about what kind of factors influence eco-cultural identity and what are the barriers to reach out to our ecological selves?
I believe we should start thinking about that all identities, you know, cultural identities, are very complex formation, right, that are historical and, of course, are situated in particular socio-political and economic context, right? So that's what Tema was referring, that scaling up about the notion of cultural identity. About the barriers, I would go a little bit with theoretical, with a little bit of the jargon, but this is the notion of what is called anthropocentrism, right? I believe once that was one of the main barriers for ecological selves. You know, the idea that basically putting ourselves or the humans placing ourselves as the center of the world, right? The way we understand we humans as the only reference to understand the world. So that is why sometimes, you know, we give value to what we call nature, what we say the environment, as long as, you know, nature and the environment satisfies our need, right? In terms, for instance, as raw material for our goods. Or sometimes, you know, nature or the environment fulfill our longings as a beautiful landscape or a romantic wilderness, right? So I believe that one of the barriers to develop these eco-cultural identities in a more positive way, I would say, is that this self-reference, you know, it's kind of an illusion of independence from the rest of the world. It's like a fiction, you know, we can live apart from what we are naming nature, right? When in reality, we are nature. And what's one of the main points we're making also in this particular, in the handbook, is that we are nature. Those are interrelations with other beings, you know, are vital to how we thrive and how we constitute ourselves.
Yeah, and I think since you brought up the word factors, right? So Jose just mentioned all sorts of things. A part of that was the factors of context that help to shape our eco-cultural identities. But when we often think about identities, we're thinking of factors like race, sex, religion, socioeconomic class, indigenous, non-indigenous, et cetera, right? All of those, one of the things that we're expanding in this handbook is the whole notion of intersectionality. So the intersectionality is not just in the social sphere, but that it also always includes the more than human sphere as well. So how do we intersect? How do we find our commonalities and also our differences in our very, all of our different ways of being? And how does that go beyond the human? So, you know, we're all mammals, right? We all breathe out oxygen. Who's breathing out carbon dioxide? How do we relate in that way? And it goes on and on in the various ways that our bodies ourselves, as Jose was just referring to, are intersectional, right? There are so many different forms of life that make up one human life. And in terms of the barriers, I also wanted to add to that. We have one chapter in here that I'm the author of that in some ways, one of the reasons this book came about, and it was because I kept on noticing these barriers in the research I was doing. So I tend to do ethnographic research. So that means I participate in what's going on in the world, I observe and write about what's happening. And I would often focus on places where people were really drawn to being with a more than human world. So for instance, people around endangered whales, and I've been in this one site for a long time now, 15 years at least. And what I have noticed there and in many other places like it is that even people who have dedicated their lives to environmental issues, to other species who live and breathe this, often will shut themselves down, silence themselves, make fun of themselves when they say something that is ecocentric, when they say something that shows love for other species or for the ocean or for the land. And I started seeing this pattern, and I started to question what's happening here. Why are we, you know, why, and or for instance, why if you're a vegetarian, do you have to explain yourself, but if you're a meat eater, you don't, right? So that's another aspect of this. So I started to notice a pattern of anthropocentrism, human centricity, that's reproduced through the ways that we put boundaries around who we can be, how we can express ourselves. And so that these boundaries are, well, you got to stay in the human-centric realm, because if you don't, you're kind of weird, right? You're crazy. You're a nut. You're different. You're a target, right? There's all sorts of different ways that manifests. So even though in many aspects of our social and cultural identities, we're seeing things change quite rapidly, right? I mean, you could see that, I think, especially right now with race and sexuality, Black Lives Matter, and with different laws and marriage changes in terms of policy in different countries, we're not budging as much in terms of ecocentrism, moving from an anthropocentric space to a space of equity across lives.
Indeed, I totally agree with what you said, because there is a common exceptionalist attitude of humans have. And when we think about the way we react to things or the way we make sense of things, we see that pattern. And as you said, and there's this human-centric and dominant paradigm. It's really hard to break that paradigm and just, you know, step forward. I'm curious.
Can I add one thing to that? Sure. Because I want to make sure that, because I see this in how I'm speaking. We is a very specific we. Even though it's a growing majority of we, right? It's those of us who are Western or have been Westernized or who are industrial, from industrial cultures, who are being industrialized, right? We're seeing this shift even in countries that have been largely indigenous. Like, I've done studies in Oman and Ethiopia, and how the shift is going from a mutualistic way of understanding life to a dualistic way of understanding life. Right, that's not just an understanding, but that is manifesting in practice. So we can look at many enduring indigenous cultures, and we're not going to see the human exceptionalism, but we are going to see that in this colonial structure that we are all part of in some way, whatever role we're playing.
Yeah, we see these differences in cultures. How do we break out of the dominant paradigm, and
What is the role of language in this process?
You know, one thing that struck me directly about this is kind of bringing attention directly to the way we speak and we talk about nature, right? And it's always this tendency of speaking about nature as something that is completely separate from us. You know, the notion of the environment is also a very detached term for what it constitutes, what is beyond our human selves. So I believe that these cultural codes are embedded in the way we speak, in the way we try to make sense of the world that is beyond our human understanding or human reality, right? And I believe that's the hardest part in terms of developing more regenerative eco-cultural identities, because it is a set of ideas, of values, and beliefs that makes us think that we are exceptional, as you mentioned, right? And so I believe that the way we talk about nature should be a way that we include ourselves in that particular notion, right? The moment that we can understand that our interdependency or the mutuality that Tema was talking about, it is constant, it is there, it's inevitable, right? We are intrinsically linked to this more than human world. Then we start reflecting that those associations, those vital connections in our own way of speaking about, not only about, but even speaking for nature, right? Giving nature this agency, this power, considering nature as a source of knowledge, right? That is also part of what we understand sometimes, that we humans are the only ones who produce knowledge and the only ones that we can learn from, right? The moment we erase ourselves from this notion of we are the center of knowledge and we are the center of production of knowledge, I believe we start understanding that we can reach out beyond ourselves, right? Beyond our only human understanding, only cultural terms to make sense of our lived experience.
Yeah, and we have a section in the handbook that's just devoted to transforming eco-cultural identity. So I think we're going to talk about what's in the handbook a little bit later, maybe.
Yeah.
But the last part, there's 6 chapters just on this. They're looking at different ways, like, that this can happen or it is happening. They're international focuses and it's across disciplines. So the book is definitely not discipline specific. So we want to bring in all the social sciences, all the humanities mm-hmm. to address this issue and to have a conversation across the disciplines, because that's the way that you can really have an effect, right? Especially to create a conversation that can be really, people can start to partake in the public sphere as well. So in this final section, we're looking at some kind of alternative white kind of settler identities, including wild tenders in North America. We're looking at indigenous and mestizo identities in Mexico and a reclaiming of campesino or peasant farming that's very much in conversation with the plants that want to grow there and are keep on coming up and planting with them. We're looking to the UK and Europe at looking at a new grammar of eco-cultural identity. So how can we actually, using a positive discourse analysis approach, how can we actually start to develop and this grammar that we can reframe how we understand ourselves? We also have this interesting study called Perceiving Eco-Cultural Identities as Human Animal Earthlings, where the author is looking at the major international human rights and environmental organizations and look at and analyzing what are their core values and how do they cut across each other, and then how can all of these values always encompass the more than human as well. So we're looking at children's educations. So how do people at a very young age, how can we actually foster more ecocentric identities? Mm-hmm. And then we're also looking at what's just happening on the ground. So we can think of our identities, they're dynamic, they're multidimensional, right? And even if I am anthropocentric in some ways, which of course I am, right, because I've been brought up in this dominant society, I'm also going to have some ecocentrism in there as well. And how does that come out? How do we foster that with each other? How do we start to hear that?
Hmm. When you talked, it sounds like gender, it's fluid. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't have to be either one way or another.
Yeah.
Doesn't have to be just only the one.
Right. And so the only thing I would say is different from gender is that whereas gender is, it's constantly manifesting and it's dynamic, but people could also argue it's not a conscious choice what gender we are, right? It's just kind of, it's just who we are. We could think of eco-cultural identity as being a more conscious choice at this point, right? Because we've lost dominant society, right? Has really lost that ecological consciousness. So it's an effort, right? Whereas gender, perhaps constructing gender and creating the gender binary, right? And performing male or female is an effort, even if we're not totally conscious of it. The ecological aspect of eco-cultural identity, we've completely lost consciousness of. And so how do we reclaim that consciousness and center it?
But I'd also say that in some ways, this is a natural next step. I think so many aspects of identity, part of the power of them is they are taken for granted, not examined. And it's not until you say, hey, why is it we don't have women being trained for any other professions other than nursing and teaching, right, in the United States 100 years ago? Why is this? Why don't women have the vote, right? And I think these conversations are happening around race. These questions are starting to happen around indigeneity. And I think one of the things I was really excited about learning about the handbook was, it's like, this is another one of these areas of taken for granted that you can't get any progress on until you make it visible and you start to examine it, so that we start to realize, oh, when I do this, when I have my family over for a barbecue, when I vote for this kind of candidate, when I use this kind of transportation infrastructure, when we adopt certain land use policies, there's a whole environmental dimension that isn't part of the conversation yet. And so almost like what we're seeing a push for in the United States around sort of, let's center race in these conversations where race wasn't really part of it as in response to Black Lives Matter. Let's also center the environment. And so I see this as being a huge sort of step to being like, hey, it's not necessarily like there's a right way or wrong way to do it, but we have to start having the conversation. And I think that kind of goes to your point of how do we do this? Well, we start talking about it.
John mentioned something very important, this idea of the tensions and the conflicts that generate in the cultural sphere, right, in the cultural field. And I would say that adding an ecocultural perspective into these relationships not only expands the possibilities of understanding relationships among culturally differentiated groups, right, by race, by ethnicity, by gender, etc., right, but also allow us to think of ways we humans could abandon the cultural trenches in this cultural war, right, and find alternative approaches to resolve, address, or manage conflicts. And I believe that's also a way of redirecting our attention. That doesn't mean that the cultural tensions and the cultural struggles are not there anymore, right? Of course, are relevant. And we are increasingly seeing this idea of the recentering of the discussion of race. And this is extremely important. But at the same time, you know, we can move also alternative ways of understanding these relationships if we redirect our attention also to start thinking about the environmental dimension or the ecological dimension and the implications of including or expanding these cultural relations by adding this perspective into our understanding of how we relate, how we connect.
Right. And I think that it's also a part of this book, and one of the efforts that we're trying to put forth is how do we interlink? Because all of these are interlinked. Right? Racism, sexism, homophobism, colonialism, anthropocentrism, right? We could put all the isms together because it's all about power over other, right? Some made other, something that is less than. And so moving to a power with position, what is what ecocentrism is about? And it's what anti-racism about, all the antis, right? But I think that we can start to see how it's not just that this is what these are about, it's that they are interlinked. So shifting from this kind of dominator mastery approach to one that is very much about reciprocity, interdependency, mutuality, starts to shift everything at once. And none of them are going to shift alone. That's the other thing, right? This is all part of the same fabric. So it all needs to shift.
Yeah, that's really powerful. Let's talk a bit about that shift from mastery to power with state. You introduce a new term called humilocene, a new epoch of humility. Can you explain how this is developed through handbook and what it is, actually?
Yeah, so we were very lucky to have David Abram be part of this handbook. He is a well-known, publicly well-known and academically well-known eco-philosopher and cultural ecologist based in the United States, who's written some beautiful books that have inspired many. And so this was another inspiration, actually, to do this handbook, is a conversation I had had with David about this whole notion that he's developing of the humilocene. And he hadn't written about it yet. And so I said, well, let's talk about it in this handbook, because it's a great way to frame everything that we're talking about in this handbook. So he has issue with the term the Anthropocene, which just kind of, when we say, oh, we're in the Anthropocene, it just centers the human again, right? So yeah, it draws attention to the fact that we are really shaping the planet right now, right? That we're literally fundamentally shaping the planet. But it doesn't take us out of this stance, right? It just kind of firmly entrenches it in our language. And there's other terms that have come forward in the academy and some of them have made it into the public sphere, like capitalocene. But again, he had issues with that, and a lot of people have issues with that. It's a great term. It helps us really understand. It's not that humans are driving this. It's that a particular economic lens on what is life is driving this, right? And that there are winners and losers, right? So it starts to complicate things. So he said, okay, well, that's a step, but it also is not there, right? It still is centering the human again. It's still centering this particular way of being. So he goes back. He's also a magician. And he looks at words and language as kind of a spell. So the whole notion of that we spell things. And so he's put forth this term, the humilocene, which comes from, so we have anthro as one root where human comes from, but we also have humus. Human comes from humus, and humus is soil. Right? And it also is the root for humility. So he develops this beautiful framing of where we are right now that has, yes, it's still a message to humans, but it doesn't necessarily center us. And it has an ethical orientation. It actually is a directional framing of where we are right now, right? So this epoch of humility and also humiliation, right? Of we will be, are, should be humiliated, right? By the action of the most dominant forces in our species, right now. And so how do we start to frame this current moment in that way so that we can start to consciously respond to this moment?
I would add that in terms of the language, because the humiliating is a new term as well. There is another term that kind of struck us during the conversation, I remember with Tema, this notion of the interbreathing, right? It's basically just going back again to the notion of interdependency that we have, right? And there was this beautiful image about, you know, what is the air we're breathing? Is what the trees, you know, are breathing out. What the tree is breathing out, we are breathing in. So we are all the time interbreathing, you know, with these other beings, which is generates this this power, for, to me especially, this powerful image or completely interdependency. So the trees are not anymore those ornamental beings, right, on the streets, or sometimes beautified beings in national parks, right? But actually, they become part of who we are in a very deeply and fleshly way, right? It's in your flesh as well. So this is also a way of understanding how our way of talking about the words we use also brings out or brings forward the humble in us, right? The humility that we should have in terms of referring to those who are not humans, or the beings that are not humans, right? So I believe that's very powerful also as a way of framing and moving forward to a world that is more interconnected as well, and more conscious of this interconnection.
Yeah, and this is from our conversation. So Jose and I did an interview, just a hanging out in the living room interview, which is our first chapter with David Abram. And one of the things I loved about interbreathing too is I think he brought that up as a response to people who come up to him and say, you know, when he does a lot of public talks of, oh, you know, great, David, yeah, I totally relate to this, except I live in the city and there's just like one tiny topiary bush, right, that I pass every day that my, and I have a dog and the dog pees on it. Like, that's my experience with nature every day. And he was like, no, 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 no. So to really start to become, it's a very fundamental life force, right? If we don't breathe, we don't live. So if we're, I mean, it goes back to so many meditation approaches, right? So many ways of being conscious. If you are aware of every breath you take, what you're taking in, who you're taking in, what you're breathing out, who you're breathing out to, then every instant of life is interconnected. And not just social and cultural, but ecological.
Yeah. Yeah. Into being is a really important concept in meditative practices. It's just, yeah.
Hmm. Yeah, so it's taking that next step, right? Yeah. It's okay, well, how can we manifest that in our consciousness? Oh, it's breathing, interbreathing. Mm. Mm.
Let's talk a bit about the cover of the book. It's an intricate kaleidoscope of plants and life. And while we won't judge a book just by its cover, can you tell what this kaleidoscope lens represents?
I don't know. Where should it start? It was a very interesting journey and conversation. We spent quite a lot of time surfing the web for a particular picture, right? I remember just looking for, it will be not perfect, but trying to bring this idea of what it is, right? The cultural identity. We always thought about it should be really impactful, and I believe we kind of reached that point. But for us, the reading, or one of, especially for me, the reading was this inner journey that we need to go through, you know, in order to also bring out transformation, right? So that's one of the readings that we can give it to this particular picture, right? But Tema might have another one, but that's the first one I have, right? This inner journey into who we are.
Yeah, hopefully, I don't know if we can put up the image with the podcast so people can see what we're talking about. We're really happy with this cover. This is an academic book for the public sphere, so it's not often that you get a good cover. Yeah, I mean, this exactly what Jose said, and also it's what you see when you look through a kaleidoscope in a way, right? So we wanted to bring forth with this handbook this, what we're calling a kaleidoscopic lens, where we can see eco-cultural identity from many, many different views, and we can also see it prismatically expanding outward. And we're trying to do that through, you know, with this 40 authors in this book. And so it's all these international settings with all these very different communities. And so we're trying to see it in all of those ways at once. There's a layer to this image that you don't see at first because it looks like, oh my gosh, here's these plants that are expanding outward from the center of some really interesting stuff going on in the center, right? But this is also a painting. So that's another layer to this, is that it is actually a human representation that's then prismatically expanding outward. So we really wanted to draw attention to the fact, too, that our representations, the stories we tell, the ways, the lenses we use to see the world absolutely shape not just ourselves, but the world.
It is clear that the book has been crafted by authors with a diverse range of experience and knowledge. With 40 authors, I'm curious about the behind-the-scenes process. Can you talk a bit about these amazing authors and who they are?
And maybe it's a good time to talk about the chapters.
Okay, so I believe that ties very good with what Tema described about the different ways to approach this concept. So in terms of disciplines, we actually have an array of disciplines coming into conversation, right? Starting from communication, from, you know, Tema and I kind of consider our kind of our main field, I would say, but also from geography and anthropology, sociology, urban studies. You know, there are several eco-linguistics, education. So actually we had a very diverse array of authors on disciplines in this. But not only about disciplines, but it's also geographically. You know, the location of the case study are kind of really goes across the globe, right? From where I am from Ecuador, right, to all the way to Ghana, to imaginaries of the Antarctic, and as well from the plains in the US, also in cities in India. So there's not only in terms of disciplines that is very diverse, but also geographically speaking. As well, the methods that we use in order to illustrate what the cultural identity is and how it is being performed or understood, right? We have ethnographic studies in this particular handbook. We have media studies. We have a whole section about how the cultural identities are mediated in different ways, in different outlets. We also have notions of analysis of discourses that are kind of in the public sphere, you know, that will inform and shape what kind of cultural identities are more acceptable or not even, right? We also have ways that we can form and foster eco-cultural identity that kind of brings out the intersection of different cultural identities within the eco-cultural framework, right? So I believe that the process was challenging in terms of trying to find a common language, you know, across the authors. And I believe Tema could expand a little bit on this, but the process of working with the authors, you know, in terms of challenging some ways of writing as well, right? Kind of challenging authors to rethink critically about the terms that we normally use as taken for granted, like nature or environment or animal or wilderness, right? So that was a very meaningful process in this handbook.
Yeah, great. And I mean, we could look at these different cases and people, we worked very closely. We did several revisions on each chapter from the idea to the end, because we wanted, even though many of us have never met, we wanted this to be a conversation and it had to have this cohesion that could then spread outward, to have a cohesion in the wider communities. And also we wanted there to be cases that could speak to each other. So for instance, we have Swedish ranchers and we have, they're not called ranchers there, they're called farmers. But, and then we have ranchers in the U.S. West dealing with very different things, but some things that relate with one another. And we have people who live in canals in Bangkok, right? And we have people who are trying to find spirituality through indigenous frames and at the same time dealing with issues of appropriation, right? So it's just these very lots and lots of interesting and wide-ranging cases. And then we also have approaches that range from family stories, looking at race and gender in urban versus rural spaces through generations, to almost technical, right, approaches to what's going on, technical approaches to water and watersheds. So it's a really wide range, so that these can all be in conversation. All these different ways of knowing and gathering knowledge can be in conversation. And another thing, and maybe we can shift over to the chapter that John is the first author on, is we have, most of these are very contemporary, looking at what's going on right now, but we also have some chapters that are looking at ancient history, looking at what are the first European patriarchal cultures that came forward and how do they bring forth a dominator identity, and how does that dominator identity stay intact today, largely through domination over women, domination over others through slavery, and also domination over non-human animals, specifically horses, and how that manifests in our statues that are coming down right now all around the world, which are dominator statues. Humans dominating horses, dominating all humans, you know, humans who are othered. And then we have some ancient, not so ancient, but more pre-colonial history looks as well. So I don't know if you want to talk about looking at pre-colonial history and what I guess specifically that means for politics today.
Sure. So, you know, going with sort of this kaleidoscopic theme, I think the chapter that I co-authored with Tema is a great representative of the kind of work that's in here, because it's not representative at all. I think it sort of is the kind of outlier that this book really brings together quite nicely. And I think your point of sort of saying, what can we learn from the current moment, reading it through other sort of alternative histories, was really a big part of the goal of what I was doing. The sort of time period that I'm looking at is pre-European contact Hawaiian history. And one of the things that's really exciting about this period, particularly right now when we're talking about how history is represented, how oftentimes the conqueror writes the story and occludes the story of the people actually were living in a place, is Hawaii was fairly unique. Literacy spread very, very quickly after European contact. And there was a small cohort of indigenous Hawaiians who sought to write down what were oral histories. So it's this really incredibly rich tradition that was captured in writing that we can now look at. And combined, there's been a much more contemporary move in archaeology and anthropology to take what had previously been sort of dismissed as legends or fables or traditions and say, wait, this was actually real history. And we can see in the archaeological record how these stories weren't just stories. They actually were reliable historical accounts of not just political shifts, but environmental, agricultural, technological, religious shifts, and you can read them in specific places and environments that are in the record. So it's this amazing opportunity to read a non-European recorded history of how people lived in a place in a very isolated way that in many ways is now very legible from a post-colonial European lens. So it gives us this really very unparalleled perspective. So to me, that's this great opportunity to say, well, if we're trying to step out of the lens on eco-cultural identity that an anthropocentric, oftentimes European-driven, often white, male, heteronormative, able-bodied perspective gives us, here's this really fascinating alternate history and alternate set of ideas and stories and ways of being that, that are fairly accessible. And that was really kind of at the root of the project I was taking on.
And there's 28 chapters, so that's just one of them. So there's lots of different ways of looking at this.
Yeah. Speaking of politics, John, you just made a really important point how the culture affects the ecological identities. And I wonder, what kind of political orientations do we need for Humulocene or for regenerative futures?
Sure, that's a wonderful question. So this gets to this particular chapter, and I'll do my best to summarize it a lot. But this was a very, I think, unusual approach to scholarship in that I was combining literature coming out of cognitive psychology with historical analysis, with archaeological analysis, and sort of coming up with a thesis that I don't think is established, but is certainly useful to think about how what we're now recognizing as psychologically based, potentially heritable, lifelong tendencies towards either left or right political identity may have served ecological functions. So I'll break that down a bit. There's been more and more research sort of looking at how people tend to be hardwired not to determine their politics, but certainly toward to have certain types of biases. And that politics, I'm not saying in the United States context, Republican versus Democrat or liberal versus labor in Australian, but more as a certain worldview that has lent itself to certain types of politics. So we sort of summarized this broad literature that oftentimes is very much too focused on countries of the core into sort of a set of overlapping and reinforcing tendencies. So what I sort of was raised to think of as conservative, the literature really describes as sort of being made up of a set of tendencies. Those tendencies include defining our in-groups, the people we identify with or the groups we identify with as being smaller, that there tends to be a greater attunement to hierarchy, a greater attunement to rules, a greater attunement to order, a higher awareness and greater reactions to threat, and also a greater tendency to view outsiders and difference negatively. We sort of lumped this under the sort of rubric of like a rivalrous political disposition, and it's tended to track onto, in a lot of different places, sort of rightward politics. On the other side, we described sort of expansive political dispositions as having a bigger, more inclusive definition of what our in-group is, greater openness to difference, more interest in novelty, and sort of a greater flexibility in social arrangements. And the interesting thing about this, as we were discussing this case study, was that I think it's very easy as somebody who identifies as being expansively politically disposed to be like, well, of course, that's the right way to do it. one of the things that was really interesting as we started to read this literature through the Hawaiian history is say, wait a second. It isn't that one is right or wrong, one is better or worse. It looks like, in the context of Hawaii, these were tools that were basically latent within human populations to help them adapt to changing ecological conditions. When there were times of plenty, having an expansive view of who my kin and my family and who I care about, being open to novelty, being open to new innovations, actually helps populations increase and thrive. And these very incredibly resourceful people who arrived on the Hawaiian Islands created this incredibly stable and multifaceted, amazing, adaptable culture in response to plenty. Interestingly enough, when populations start to grow so large that it's hard to feed people, you start to hitting the limits of the carrying capacity of the land. Having people rise to leadership with a more rivalrous disposition actually enabled more conflict. There was less expansive approaches towards outsiders. There was war, and you also see populations leveling out. So both of these sort of dispositions enabled humans to survive on this archipelago where there wasn't a chance to get a container ship full of food from Australia, where there wasn't a chance to adopt a bunch of technologies from somewhere else. So all this is by way of saying, I think we have to take the political perspectives of people who might not see things the way we do as not just being not bad, but potentially having some really powerful value as we look how we're going to try to be more environmentally resilient and deal with the environmental challenges we have. That doesn't mean the way we've articulated sort of left and right has been good. And it doesn't mean that the way we exist as either somebody with an expansive or a rivalrous sort of political bias necessarily has solving the problems we have. I think both of these identities are, the way we articulate them now, are vastly contributing to the problem. And we kind of need to rethink both while recognizing that they're a little bit and need to be baked into who we are as a species.
We need to rethink them eco-culturally.
We need to rethink them eco-culturally, exactly. Mm-hmm. And that's a big shift, I think, both on the left and the right.
I believe, politically speaking as well, is that, again, I like to return to this idea of how we understand intercultural relations, right? Because I believe that that was one of the things that drove me to start thinking about cultural relations in terms of eco-culture, right? And for instance, in the chapter I wrote, my contribution, what I try to show is how an eco-cultural identity lens expands the understanding of intercultural relations. Usually when we talk about intercultural relations, we usually think about relationships occurring among human groups or individuals that identify, again, you know, by race, gender, sexuality, etc., right? And of course, ethnicity, which is my main focus. So depending on the context in which these relationships occur, one identity or the intersection of several identities becomes more salient in the relationship. And those are more likely to influence the kind of intercultural relations among groups. For instance, in my case study, the one that I wrote about, it is easy to pinpoint that the main cultural category influencing the relationships between mestizos, Afro-descendants, and indigenous in the Ecuador-Colombia border is their ethnicity. It's pretty obvious there. And this usually intersects with class, right? For instance, mestizos are usually landowners, while indigenous Awa, which is the population I collaborated with, usually work as a peasant in their land. So you see the intersection of ethnicity and class. But however, when I was doing the interviews and was reviewing some of the documents, I noticed that the Awa people, in their narrations, they explain their relationships with mestizos and Afros not in terms of class or ethnicity, right? Those categories were not the salient identifiers. So an ecocultural lens allowed me to redirect my attention to the non-human actor that was central in these relationships. In this particular case, the non-human actor was basically the territory of the Awa people, right? Their territory, what they call Katsasu, is the non-human that gets sick, it is troubled, is poisoned, as well as it's a subject of respect and connection. So the identity of the Awa people and as all identities, as we've been arguing here, are eco-cultural, right? Insofar as their identity are intrinsically connected to the well-being of their territory. So the ecological dimension of Awa's identity materializing their territory is vital to understand the relationships of this population with other populations. So it is not only centering the idea of class and ethnicity in understanding how they interrelate and the possible conflicts that might arise and the possibilities of collaboration that might arise from that perspective, but also bringing the territory as an actor that influences and shapes the way they connect. So I believe that's one interesting approach, because that also influences political approaches to how to deal and how to find new ways of dealing with conflict, right? Intercultural conflict in this particular case.
Yeah, that sounds really interesting, and it's too much to take in. I'm like, whoa.
It's kind of like 28 books in one.
It's like, wow. Yeah, I mean, there are many different voices and positionality towards environmental issues and our reality, basically. And given its complexity, everyone has a different things to say based on their ethnicity, their political orientation, as you said, and their own interpretation of things. I want to share a quote of yours that really struck me. I think it's yours, Tema. And it says, "The handbook reintegrates what it means to be human and reimagine the many ways we identify that are of the essence to whether we can think and cultivate our ways into habitable futures." Can you tell us a bit about how the handbook challenged us to think and cultivate our ways into a habitable future?
Yeah, so that's from Jose and me. That's our introduction. It comes back to kind of how we started this, right? It's really about a paradigm shift in dominant societies. And so if we are going to have futures that we can breathe in, that we can still be interbreathing in, right? And that others can as well, not just the humans, but all the other species and elements and dimensions that we are related with and related to, we have to shift our paradigm to acknowledge that, right? That these relations and our centeredness, not that we are the center, but that we are not exceptional, right? That we may be exceptional in the actions we've been taking that are so destructive, but starting to realign and to reorient ourselves so that the steps that we take forward are not just sustainable, but they're restorative, they're regenerative, that we don't just have futures that we can still survive in, but that we can also thrive in, right? That we can flourish and then we can mutually flourish. That's the only way that that's going to happen.
Hmm. Yeah. Kind of Tema stole a little bit my words about that, you know. Thank you for that. You know, because I was thinking about the notion of habitable futures as thriving together with, right? And I believe that's one of the key. And I go back to the interdependency that we have, because sometimes we forget. And I mean we, because I was very deep into my notion of I can do it by myself, right, as a human being, right? And I believe that also brings the idea of the technological approach we have to the world, right? We think that we can fix things only or mainly through technology, right? We can actually fix the environment, you know, with more technological advance. However, I believe that without considering that we actually, our technology, our human technology also has limitations in order to approach the tremendous changes that are happening in terms of the environment with the climate crisis and the climate emergency that we're living through. I believe that we need to become conscious about this need that we have of other beings for us to thrive and flourish.
And the thing I would also add, just having looked through a number of these chapters, is just, it's also a call to recognize that identity is also a resource for addressing these. I think it's really easy to be like, right, the way we identify ourselves as consumers or we identify ourselves as voters, it's like we keep getting in our own way. But we have aspects of our identities that are deeply important. People across the political spectrum have deep attachment to place, right? And that matters. When I was looking over my chapter again, when I was looking at this definition of sort of rightward, rivalrous political disposition, an attunement to hierarchy, rules, and order. That's part of what's helped Australia and New Zealand respond to coronavirus, right? I mean, there are times when these are things that we might not always be as comfortable with, or we might see gets in our way. There might be aspects that are also actually the key for communities to becoming more environmentally resilient.
Yeah. It seems to me we're living in a cultural illusion in the face of environmental crisis. And I feel like this book takes that lid off that illusions, you know?
It's making me think of our identities are responsive as well, right? So, for instance, we have this really interesting chapter in here that is about, it's called Induce, I'm not going to read the chapter title, it won't really explain what it's about, but it's about fossil fuel drilling has been causing earthquakes, right, in different places, but specifically this chapter is about Oklahoma, which used to have almost none and now has hundreds a year, and a place that was very conservative, was very people identified with the fossil fuel companies. The fossil fuel companies worked hard to have that happen because they would, you know, they'd sponsor education interventions in the schools, they'd sponsor the big community events, and there was a lot of pride around drilling in Oklahoma. People literally have been shaken. Their selves have been shaken, right? Their foundations have been shaken. And there has been a massive shift in just a few years from an outlook that was, you know, just this is all fine, this is all good, let's keep, you know, extracting, to wait a second, this is actually damaging. This is actually destroying not just the land around us, but who we are. It's dangerous. And so people who never would have called themselves activists now are activists. And so I think that understanding also that our identities are ecologically responsible and responsive can be, is the paradigm shift we need.
Yeah, right. Could you talk a bit about your narrative approach for communicating a more than human lens to your readers in the book?
I would say that the first thing is surrender. I really like this notion of surrender. It is that we actually hold very tight, very close to ourselves, who we are as a species, right? As humans, right? We don't see ourselves beyond that. And I believe I'm speaking from personal experience because that was one of my personal journey about those surrendering all my notions about who I am as a living being in this planet. We talk about this, what is called the planetary positionality, right? How I am positioned as a human being in this planet, and to what extent the things I do, the decisions I make, the way I relate to other beings also kind of shapes who I am as a person in my identity. So my journey is pretty interesting also because that it's a little bit reflected in the handbook and the interest in the handbook because I recently became a vegetarian, right? And it was in a struggle of more than 20 years. And that particular shift, and hopefully nobody will take it that long, right? But in my case, you know, because it was a very difficult journey. And that kind of gives you the idea of how entrenched we are in our humanity, right? Because sometimes we identify as human as those that consume the other, in this particular case, animals, right? So my personal struggle about realizing that I can have a different relationship with animals that brought me into kind of make it clear the ecological dimension, that this part that it was beyond who I am as a human. And that created a personal shift, right? But at the same time, even though this shift is at an individual level, that will scale up to take positions in policy about the food industry, for instance, right? So it is those relationships are very close. So to answer your question, that would be surrendering, right? Surrender to this very human self we have. And maybe we will become more humble in that relationship.
I love that idea of surrender. Permeability, transcorporeality, right? That we're not these, I think that that's another thing that we really wanted to bring across, is that there can be this kind of sense of ownership, rigidity, and almost that we are these like little container units walking around, right? No, we're very much in conversation all the time, who we are, what we are, how we are. And so shifting into that notion of selves as a relationship in themselves, and then trying to shift language itself to represent that. Our language is very limited, right? And our language is a major social force in terms of reproducing a status quo, right? It's very difficult to shift our language. And because of that, it's also very difficult, because that language is constantly producing reality, it's very difficult to create new realities. And so one of the things we try to do in this handbook across chapters is work with each scholar, we have one person who's more of an advocate, activist than a scholar, but mostly scholars who are coming from different disciplines, where already the disciplines have a rigidity in terms of how you present things and the words you use. And all major disciplines, even the biological, tend to be anthropocentric, right? So how do we shift out of an anthropocentric frame in the way we think, write, and also get into this notion of selfhood as not something we own and hold on tight to, but as something that is a dynamic and transformative space and has transformative potentials beyond the self, right? Beyond the group identity as well. I think it was lots of reviewing and revising and conversing, but then it was also just some simple language shifts, right? I think that Jose brought up earlier. Always, if you're going to use terms that reproduce a notion of humans as separate from the more than human world, do so reflexively. Don't just throw them out there and keep on using them, right? So if you're going to use the environment, make sure that you use that reflexively and you show that in your work, why you're using it. Well, this is a limitation. I have to use this because what else am I going to use in this setting? Well, maybe you can use the ecological. Maybe you could use the more than human world. Maybe you can use some other terms that actually communicate what you want to communicate, right? And the perceptual shifts you're engaged in, or your culture has to offer. But there's so many ways we all have to be really brave right now. Right? Because if we're not brave, nothing's going to change, right? And we're not going to be around for very long. So we have to, it seems like it shouldn't be that brave to speak differently, but it is, it's a very brave act. And you have to work at it, and you have to work with the other people you're speaking with to keep the conversation going. Otherwise, it just screeches to a halt.
Yeah, it's reconstructing a reality that linguistically and discursively shaped as much as it's shaped by other things. And when I started to read this book, I felt like I was looking into the heart of an artichoke. Because like when we think about the heart, it matters the most, and things are often layered and more complex than they seem. And when we can't just wish it away, but we have to reshape things inside. So I think this book is really powerful and visionary. We're running out of time.
Can I add to that? And I know we're running out of time. It's not good of me to interrupt you saying that we're running out of time. But
wait, there's more.
I did want to bring up the book Sand Talk. Which is a new book out now by an Australian author, indigenous author, who is something you just said I think is really interesting, the heart of an artichoke and kind of the unnecessary complexity of all the leaves, although there's some tasty bits, right, on those leaves. So how do we get, so what Sandtalk is talking about is kind of this Western dominating culture has put in a lot of complications. It's not complicated, it's just become complicated, right? So how do we get to this simple yet complex heart of the matter? And it's really nice to hear that you feel like the handbook is doing that.
My last question is, what projects are you working on now the handbook is over? What's next for you?
Sleeping?
Yes, that would be a good idea, right? I was thinking of how can I bring more clearly this eco-cultural approach into the classroom, right? And I believe Tema has developed this perspective, this eco-cultural pedagogy into that, of which I was part. So I believe the handbook kind of gives us a larger framework in order to bring these kind of conversations into the classroom. And I've been thinking, and that's kind of a confession I'm doing here in front of everyone, but I'm rethinking a lot, not only the way I teach, right, or I share in the classroom, but also use it as a way of reframing even the objectives of the classroom, right? Mm-hmm. I was looking at the famous Bloom's taxonomy, that is kind of the major frame about how you evaluate or how you understand education. And it's very interesting for sure, it helps you a lot. But what struck me, it was that you cannot use words as filling, right, in terms of understanding how education can be transformative. And I believe that that could be interesting to start understanding and the eco-cultural framework in education about bringing up the emotional part, the feeling part, into a way of actually being something that must be encouraged in the classroom and in our way of teaching or in our pedagogies if we want them to be critical and transformative as well.
Right. And Jose, you've worked with me on a chapter, Teaching from the Inside Out. Right, is to create transformative education, we have to start with where is each of us coming from? And two of you have been in my classes, right? And one of the things we have done in at least one of my classes is we write, I think it's in both that you've been in, we do free writes, right? Stream of consciousness, so that mm-hmm. we can take those core questions to what we're learning. Like when I say nature, I mean this, or when I say environment, I mean this. And then move those outward from inside passions and inquiries to what does that mean with the concepts we're dealing with right now to what is my path in the world, right? How can I make a difference?
Well, which is actually a perfect transition because one of the things I'm working on this week is something that Jose and Tamar are co-authors on, which is taking off of these free rights. A lot of what we've been talking about is shifting how we talk, and in this way, sort of shifting our identities in these broader moves. And it's a large data set that a number of our colleagues have helped generate around what the meaning of nature is. What I'm focusing on is how, for a number of the respondents we've had, people are starting to recognize that they are nature, that nature is in their home, it's in their intimate lives. And that a number of the responses might start out, well, when I say nature, I mean rivers and trees, but I guess also it's in my backyard, but I guess then maybe the cockroach on my floor. And you see these really interesting journeys as people are starting to recognize that nature might even include things we never would have included before. Human systems, laws, economics, the way we interact with each other. And while this doesn't fix things, I do think we're starting to see around the edges these really drastic changes in how we identify ourselves, and thus we articulate what our futures are going to be. Hmm. So I think it's happening. It doesn't happen all at once, but working through this particular part of the research that my colleagues have been generating really gives me a lot of hope around how our identities are shifting very quickly.
I think that all of us have a lot of projects we're working on also that we are not going to list right now, yeah. but we do, the three of us actually have plans. We've been getting this book out first to do a study on an assignment that we've all been giving in our courses. Denise, you took part in this, mm-hmm. which is screen-free, having tech-free, that's the word, a break, but also...
Detox.
I mean, there's all sorts of ways. A Sabbath, right?
Mm-hmm. A holiday from technology.
And what does that do to our eco-cultural identities? What does that do to the ways we relate with others, not mm-hmm. just the human and others? Because we have all seen in our classes when we've done this just far more profound results than we thought we would have when we started it. Now, Jose, I think you're the first person who did this in your class. I had thought about it, and then you did it.
Yeah, I believe so. And it was, for me, was, you know, very interesting and sometimes shocking to to notice some patterns in the responses of students. And when we turn again our lenses into the students call nature, right, or the environment, we notice that the environment usually disappears, you know, when they are mediated by the screens, or maybe their understanding shifts in different directions. So yes, so I believe we were very excited about that project. It became a halt a little bit. Let's see if we can retake that after all the circumstances. But I believe it's a good way to also incorporate technology in our understanding of what we see as, or what, how we understand and how we connect with the more than human world. For sure.
Yeah. Hmm. This book has been a 3-year project, so it's taken up a lot of our research time.
Yeah, I can imagine. Having read the introduction, I think that if we could start a global book club and the majority of people picked up this handbook, things would be significantly different. So if one of our listeners would like to find out more and read this book, can you tell us where they can find it?
So in terms of book clubs, book groups, this is an expensive book because it's a handbook, right? And it's big and... So I recommend that people ask their libraries to order the book and get it on the shelves so it's available to the public, whether it's your university library or your city library.
And in physical form or an ebook form.
That's right.
This book is inspiring, empowering, and very useful. Tema, John, and Jose, thank you so much for the richness of your work and our conversation today. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you.
Thanks for the opportunity.
We have a special offer for our listeners. If you would like to have this essential book to enrich your library, use code ACR02 for 25% off your purchase. This code is valid until June 26, 2021. For this episode, I'd like to say a special thanks to Bonnie Paris for editing the script and Chris Jofordis for his technical support. I'm Dana Zilis, and thank you for listening.